for her to. All right, we'll get started. Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for attending this symposium that has been planned at a relatively short notice than what we're used to. The reason why we are here today is to talk and hear from some experiences in the developing world from researchers, clinicians, and program managers who have worked for many years and a large part of their career in addressing problems related to maternal and child health in developing countries. We are indeed fortunate that this symposium could come by as a result of a site visit or reverse site visit by some of our colleagues from India whom we are engaged in a new research collaboration. And that resulted in this symposium being a possibility and they agreeing to present some of their work, as well as a distinguished colleague here who has recently joined the faculty at Vanderbilt, Dr. Mark Newton, and I'll introduce some of the things which Mark has been involved in. It's part of our series of symposia that are being planned through the Institute for Global Health. You obviously were present, many of you were present for the symposium that was focused on training partnerships just a couple of months ago. And I'm delighted to welcome all of you on behalf of the Institute for Global Health. My name is Vikrant Sahasrabuddhe. I work as an assistant professor of pediatrics in the Institute for Global Health and the Division of Infectious Diseases. I'm going to introduce the speakers today, and before making further announcement, I'd like to do a bit of housekeeping. One is the program that's printed on the flyer has unfortunately had to undergo some changes. Two changes. In the interest of time and given the fact that we are meeting late on a Friday afternoon and logistical troubles, we had to curtail the four talks down to two more relevant, more important, and I would say talks which cover really the gamut which was being covered in four talks. But I'm really glad that even though we have less number of talks, we'll be having an exciting panel discussion with the speakers who were originally supposed to talk, just in the interest of time. We have Dr. Shiv Prasad Gowdar, who is the professor and director of the Department of Medical Education at the Jawaharlal Nehru Medical College in Belgaum in India. He is here this afternoon. I'm going to introduce him before I get into some of the initial introduction slides. Dr. B.R. Desai, who is also here and will be participating in a panel discussion, is chair of the Department of OBGYN at the same institution. Fortunately, Dr. Mario Rojas, who is going to talk about his experiences in Colombia, is down with flu and has expressed his regrets that he is not going to be able to make it this afternoon. But we do have our newest distinguished faculty at the Institute for Global Health, Dr. Mark Newton, who is going to talk about his experiences in Africa, and we'll get to that in a minute. I just wanted to get this conversation started by showing you a bit of what we're going to deal with. We're going to, essentially talk about all the problems and the ways in which these problems are being addressed. But just as a initial starting point, I want to emphasize that in the last 50 years, most population growth has happened in the lesser developed parts of the world, as is very evident in this graph. It's as a result of direct fertility rates as well as a host of factors related to development. If you look at the distribution of the world's population, as it's very evident through these population pyramids, most of the developing countries or the less developed countries have a traditional pyramidal-shaped population pyramid, so to speak, where a significant proportion of the population is below the ages of 15. It's not the same in more developed regions of the world, where it's more of an equal distribution across the age groups. If you look at the top 10 causes of death in children who form a large part of the population in developing countries, the contrasts are pretty stark. The perinatal conditions or conditions that are associated or, diseases that are associated around the time of childbirth are the leading cause of death in the 0 to 14 age group in children in the lower and middle income countries. It's much different in terms of the actual magnitude of the problem. Although perinatal conditions also dominate the top 10 causes, you can see the figure here is only 0.03 million, whereas it's a magnitude of 200 times more in developing countries. As you can also see, a number of these diseases in the top 10 list are essentially diseases related to either infectious diseases, poverty, or development, all characterized by a lack of access to healthcare, as well as superimposing with lack of education and ignorance. A number of these diseases are preventable, either vaccine-related or through better access to healthcare strategies. That is where the real challenge lies in ensuring improving access, as well as evaluating strategies which can address some of these drastic conditions. The continuity of care in the field of women's and child health extends from the time a woman gets pregnant all the way towards adulthood by passing through a phase in which the child is most vulnerable to dying, that is in the neonatal period, the infancy period, as well as the preschool and adolescent period, where there are a number of conditions that make children in developing countries vulnerable. Obviously, access to safe sexual and reproductive health services as the child progresses into the reproductive years forms and completes this whole cycle, which is characterized in a very nice review article by Kerber et al. In Lancet last year. The continuity of care extends at various levels, but chiefly at the tertiary level where the hospitals and the health facilities exist for treating indoor patients or hospices, as well as outpatients and outreach services where even with a small intervention or a minimal face time with the physician, a number of things can be achieved. Obviously, a significant proportion gets done in the communities and the family and the families which actually can do a lot of difference in taking care of kids as well as mothers who are at risk of dying around the time of childbirth. It's really important to emphasize that all of these levels of healthcare, so to speak, should have an appropriate linkage mechanisms so that appropriate referral and follow-up care is followed. This graph just shows the number of young women between the ages of 20 and 24 who had a child before the age of 18. And as you can see, most of them were, the significant proportion of young women in South and Southeast Asia, as well as in Africa, were having, essentially teenage pregnancies. I'm also trying to give a bit of a background about what type of populations we're dealing with. We're dealing with a young, sexually active population, which needs access to contraceptive and family planning services. Unfortunately, that access is severely restricted in many parts of the world, as is very evident in this graph, where access to services in the age group of 15 to 19 is much lower than that in the age groups of 20 to 24. And superimpose that with this proportion, where a number of women before the age of 18 had actually got pregnant and had a child. The disability-adjusted life years, or DALYs, which is a measure of both the morbidity and mortality, a combination synthetic measure which measures across various health outcomes and various health conditions. If that is shown by age groups between the ages of 5 and 14 and between the ages of 15 and 29, you can see that sexual and reproductive conditions, including maternal causes and perinatal causes, maternal causes around the perinatal period account for almost a third of the disability-adjusted life years lost in this age group. I also want to emphasize some of the things which you'll be hearing in this conversation, the causes of maternal mortality and the ways in which these are being addressed. A significant proportion are being around the most important cause, which is hemorrhage, or more specifically hemorrhage that happens after pregnancy or postpartum hemorrhage. The trends in neonatal mortality, as you can see here, in most low- and middle-income countries, the number of neonatal deaths per 1,000 live births is a huge number, although it has come down in the last two decades. But by no means, even in the last decade, this number is unacceptably high as compared to the numbers in high-income countries. This is the setting where we're dealing with. This is where most of the problems arise. There's a big lack of healthcare manpower. Just a description about how many physicians are there per 1,000 people. As you can see, in the country of Mali, there's less than a tenth physician, so to speak, per 1,000 people, or more specifically, one physician per million people. Or, well, the numbers are probably a magnitude of 200 times higher in the United States or in most developed countries. I've put Cuba as an interesting contrast there. I'm going to leave it at this. This is where we are headed. We are trying to keep our promise, which the world community made for itself, that by the year 2015, we are going to try to achieve these goals. There are 8 achievable goals, which are characterized as the United Nations Millennium Development Goals, and 4 of which, or rather 5 of which, are directly related to health, which include reducing child mortality, improving maternal health, combating HIV, AIDS, malaria, and other diseases, as well as a significant proportion of health which goes into promoting gender equality and empowering women. Dr. Bill Fige said that the world cannot be allowed to exist half healthy and half sick. I think I'm going to leave it at that, and I'm going to invite Dr. Shiv Prasad Gowder to give his talk and how his institution is making a difference in addressing some of these problems. While Dr. Gowder is coming up on the stage, I'll just give a brief introduction about him. He is our newest collaborator on our HIV and cervical cancer project, which I work with our colleagues in India. We are hoping to set up a new site in the next couple of months with Jawaharlal Nehru Medical College and KLE University in Belgaum. And Dr. Gowder is a physiologist by training, but one of the few people who realizes the importance of public health as being more important than quite a few other disciplines and has made that as his passion. He's a professor of physiology and director of the Department of Medical Education at JNMC, and he's also research coordinator of the Global Women's and Child Health Network site, which is a part of an elite group of institutions both in the United States and across the world. I guess about 5 sites in Africa, 3 in Africa, 2 in Latin America, and 3 in Asia. And JNMC and Dr. Gowder are leading that effort, and he's going to talk about some of the things. So I really welcome and thanks for making the time out of your schedules to come.
Thank you very much, Vikrant, for that wonderful introduction, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I know what it is like to be sitting in a symposium like this on a Friday evening at 4:30, but bear with me for the next, hopefully, 15, 20 minutes. I'll share with you some of the programs, some of the projects that we have implemented in Belgaum, addressing the kind of things that Vikrant was mentioning. That is a nice frame up for the discussion that we would like to have with you all. The work that I am presenting today is actually what we have been doing in the last 7 years as part of this NICHD Global Network for Women's and Children's Health Research. And Professor Kotkani, a very senior professor of obstetrics and gynecology at our institute, he has basically led this effort, and I've been fortunate to be part of this whole group, which has tried to basically address what currently is being called as implementation science. If your translational research, call what you may be, but this is not bench science. We are trying to take tested interventions out into the community and see whether we can make them work. So that's basically what we have tried to do as part of this effort. So at the outset, I bring greetings to you all from my institute back home in Belgaum. We also have a unique distinction of being the second oldest private medical school in the whole country. We also are an autonomous university since last 2 years. For those of you who are probably not so familiar with India and where Belgaum is, maybe many of you have heard about Bangalore or Bombay. So we are right in the middle between Bangalore and Bombay in the southern part of the country. So what I'm presenting to you, as I said earlier, this is a title that Vikrant gave me, you know, Building the Evidence for Maternal and Child Health in India. So I'll present basically two major efforts that we have done at our site, one addressing maternal mortality and the other one addressing neonatal mortality. So we are one of the 10 sites of the global network. As I mentioned earlier, the sites are in Asia, Africa, South America, and Central America. The network came together in 2001. We recompeted and we were renewed in 2007, and we are now getting into the second phase of the network. The primary research focus for the network has been to basically look at community-based interventions for reducing maternal and infant mortality and morbidity, develop evidence-based interventions that can be applied in the low-resource settings which really need, you know, outreach activities and outreach interventions, and overall bring about an improvement in the healthcare delivery practices of the so-called disadvantaged healthcare providers. So the first trial that we initiated way back in 2002 was this community-based trial of oral misoprostol, a prostaglandin derivative, for prophylaxis of or for prevention of postpartum hemorrhage. The study was conducted over 19 subcenters or the rural health posts, covering a population of nearly 100,000. And the auxiliary nurse midwives, who are the lowest cadre of healthcare providers in the primary healthcare model, they were the ones who were responsible for, you know, enrolling the women and randomizing the women, administering the intervention and measuring the outcome. The intervention was 600 micrograms of misoprostol or placebo, administered within 5 minutes of delivery of the baby. The primary outcome for the study was measurement of postpartum blood loss, and this is a drape that our group developed for measurement of blood loss, has been validated in a couple of hospital settings. So the trial lasted 2.5 years. We enrolled 1,600 women to the trial, and the results were really encouraging. We had a 47% reduction in the incidence of acute postpartum hemorrhage. And when I say acute postpartum hemorrhage, we're talking about 500 ml of blood loss within the first 2 hours after delivery. We also had a significant reduction in severe postpartum hemorrhage, that is more than 1,000 ml, although the numbers are relatively small. The study was basically designed to test for reduction in acute postpartum hemorrhage. As a follow-up of that trial, we had a major dissemination effort in Goa, India, where majority of the major stakeholders assembled, and the findings of the trial have been published. The primary paper was published in the Lancet of 2006. The Goa conference proceedings themselves have been published as a supplement of the International Journal of Gynecology and Obstetrics. And as a follow-up of the Goa dissemination meeting, our group was invited to be a part of the WHO consultation on looking at recommendations for prevention of postpartum hemorrhage. And this is the recommendation that came out of that technical consultation, that in the absence of active management of third stage labor, whether uterotonics alone can be used for prevention of postpartum hemorrhage. And based on the evidence that's available, the recommendation is that either oxytocin or misoprostol can be used or should be offered by a health worker for the prevention of postpartum hemorrhage. In terms of scaling up of this intervention, there's been a fair bit of work that has happened in India. The Ministry of Health approved the use of misoprostol for prevention of postpartum hemorrhage by the nurse midwives. The drug is now registered for this particular indication. Guidelines for the use of misoprostol for prevention of PPH by ANMs have been put in place by the ministry, and the training of the ANMs for the use of misoprostol through the district health training centers has also started. Our center, again led by Dr. Kotkani, was identified as a nodal center for training of the medical college faculty as well as the medical officers working in the primary health care centers for upgrading their skills in skilled birth attendance. And this project was taken up between March and December 2007. So basically, the story of misoprostol trial from a simple RCT in a population of 100,000 has now literally been scaled up into a national program. So that's basically what has been our work related to reduction of maternal mortality. In 2005, the Global Network again launched a major effort looking at training community-based health providers in newborn resuscitation. And the aim of the project was to see whether the training of the health workers with the WAP NRP program can have any incremental reduction in early neonatal mortality rate, that is, the newborn deaths within the first 7 days of life. So this is a cluster randomized trial which has been conducted over six of the Global Network sites. We are just about completing this trial, and we almost have nearly 90,000 births captured to this trial. So this probably represents one of the largest such efforts in the world, looking at training healthcare providers for newborn resuscitations. At our site, we had 26 of the 90 clusters that participated in this trial, covering a population of almost 900,000. And as part of this program, we have trained more than 1,000 birth attendants, ranging all the way from the trained physicians, MD, OBGYNs, all the way down to illiterate traditional birth attendants. The program basically occurred over the last 3 years, starting with a baseline training of the birth attendants for newborn assessment and data collection. So these are some of the pictures from those training sessions. And these are the illiterate traditional birth attendants who have for the first time in their life have, you know, provided some kind of training in, you know, auscultation and Apgar scoring and identification of stillbirths versus early neonatal deaths. Following that, we had some baseline data collection, and then we introduced the WHO ENC course. These are the major components, you know, clean delivery practices, newborn resuscitation with bag and mask, using room air, establishing immediate skin-to-skin contact, and early initiation of breastfeeding. So in terms of the location of births, and Belgaum is a fairly moderately well-developed district compared to some of the other regions of the country, you still see that nearly half of the deliveries are occurring at home. This is the data from the baseline period of the study, almost 10,000 deliveries in this data set. In terms of the type of birth attendants who are conducting these deliveries, again, you'll see that nearly a third of the deliveries are still being conducted by the untrained traditional birth attendants. So we did compare the practices prior to ENC training versus the change in practices post ENC training, and we did have a significant improvement in one establishment of skin-to-skin contact between the mother and the baby, initiation of early breastfeeding. In terms of the babies who received resuscitation, you see that there's a slight reduction in the percentage. It may look a little surprising, but when you look at the resuscitation practices, this makes more meaning in terms of, you know, the right practices were promoted, and some of the wrong practices that were being used by the health providers disappeared. There was a big improvement in the resuscitation using bag and mask, whereas some of the unwanted practices disappeared. In terms of impact on mortality, we have a huge reduction in both early neonatal mortality as well as stillbirth rate. So there's overall a reduction in perinatal mortality. So obviously ENC training did work. We were able to reduce both the ENMR and the perinatal mortality rate. It is possible to train even illiterate traditional birth attendants with appropriate resuscitation practices. The reduction in stillbirth rate is something which occurred because of the training that was provided to the birth attendants in distinguishing between a stillbirth versus early neonatal death. The later part of the study, that is the impact of the NRP training, that's yet to be assessed. The data collection is winding up sometime next month. So over the next few months, we'll know whether NRP was able to add on or produce any incremental reduction in early neonatal mortality. So these are the two major trials that our group has been involved in. We are also involved in another study which came as a follow-up of this first breath. The logic was that the babies which otherwise would have died were saved through newborn, through resuscitation. But will they end up with increased morbidity? And if so, is there a need for any kind of home-based intervention that can be provided to improve their, you know, long-term outcomes? So we are doing this home-based intervention based on the Partners for Learning curriculum, where village counselors who have been trained for the study provide twice a month, they visit the families at home and using pictorial material provide or counsel the mothers to promote the growth and development of the child. The project is expected to go over 3 years. So all these babies will be followed up for 3 years, and at the end of the third year, we'll look at whether the home-based intervention was able to improve their outcome in terms of cognitive, social, and motor development. So another small project that was done in the area was looking at the association between consanguineous unions and low birth weight. In our part of the country, in South India, consanguineous unions between uncle and niece are fairly common, and the prevalence in our area is around 24%, and the incidence of low birth weight does appear to have some direct relationship to such consanguineous unions. Other ongoing research projects, we are also looking at iron and zinc absorption in a community which is predominantly vegetarian. Vegetarian sources are not supposed to be ideal in terms of the provision of iron and zinc, but meat-based products or meat-based supplements are not really accepted by the community. So we are looking at the sprinkles, which can be added as a supplement to the regular vegetarian diet. We are on the verge of launching a couple of what I think are fairly ambitious programs. One of the major problems in many of the developing countries is that there is really no vital registration system. And what we are hoping to do over the next 5 years is to set up a maternal and newborn health registry so that at least the basic indicators could be captured on an ongoing basis in an accurate manner. And complementing that registry system, we are also planning to introduce a comprehensive EMOC package, which basically looks at three components: training of the birth attendants to identify some of the common obstetric conditions, then develop the quality of care at the referral hospitals, and build a support structure through community involvement so that appropriate referrals can be initiated and accomplished. So these are projects which are in the pipeline, which are set to be rolled out in the next few months. So finally, we have this new initiative which really brings our group to this great institute. We are very happy to be here. This is a new beginning, and I hope and I'm confident that we'll be able to develop this into a real major program. There are, I think, lots of opportunities for collaboration, and we are excited. So on that note, I once again thank Vikrant for the wonderful invitation, and of course NICHD and the Gates Foundation for the funding support for all these various trials that we have been involved in. So thank you.
Thank you for the very enlightening presentation, Dr. Gowder. I think we'll reserve the questions towards the end, because I think the panel will be a very exciting way of discussing things. May I invite Dr. Mark Newland to join us here, and I'm going to introduce Mark in a minute. Just put up the slides. Mark is an anesthesiologist. He is graduated with a degree from University of Texas, as well as did his internship and residency at the University of Texas, as well as a fellowship from the Denver Children's Hospital. He is an anesthesiologist, but he has worked in primary care for many years. For the last 8 years, he was staying full-time and working in Kenya and working in a number of East African settings, including Sudan, Somalia, and Ethiopia. Mark brings a truly multidisciplinary expertise to his work. He understands primary care. He has been there, done that. A number of things what he's bringing to the Institute are laying the foundation for a variety of programs that are being planned related to maternal and child health. And I'm really glad Mark agreed to present at the symposium at a very short notice. And we're going to hear from him the East African perspective on maternal and child health issues. Thanks for coming in.
Well, it's good to be here this afternoon. I mean, it's amazing that these guys are able to lecture after flying on a plane such long distances and then sitting in the airport for a couple of hours. So thanks for that lecture. That was great. I am an anesthesiologist. I'm a pediatric anesthesiologist. I work at the Vanderbilt Children's Hospital. I've been here for about 6 months, and it's certainly good to be here. And you're probably wondering why an anesthesiologist would want to talk about maternal and child health. So my job today is try to convince you that there's actually a role, even for an anesthesiologist, in maternal and child health. And here you go. So I think the first thing I need to do is, you know, I'm a clinician. I mean, and when you see these bar graphs and you see these numbers, you kind of are skewed to actually what we're talking about. And so I had prepared my lecture about 2 weeks ago, but a couple days ago I received a letter from one of my friends that works in Namibia. And I think especially as a student, they need to be able to kind of put together the bar graphs with actual people. And so if you don't want to hear anything very clinically bad, close your ears, because I'm about to tell you a story about three women straight from Africa, and this will describe what we're talking about when we talk about maternal child health, and those numbers will represent a person, and it'll mean someone. So let me read these stories. This was sent by a doctor friend of mine who is a primary care doctor working in Namibia, northern Namibia. A 15-year-old girl who labored for 4 days at home before eventually being brought to our hospital. By the time the baby was dead and her uterus and bladder were horrifically ruptured, I immediately took her to the operating room where the deceased baby was found floating freely outside the womb in the sea of blood. The surgery was anxiety-producing, to say the least, and I was concerned that I would also lose the mother on the operating room table. She lived through the operation and her turbulent postoperative care, but a week after surgery, she developed a large vesico-vaginal fistula. And then there was another lady that came in just a few days after this lady, and she was referred to us from Angola. Angola is the country that's just next to Namibia. The family attempted to deliver her at home with a traditional birth attendant. They successfully delivered the baby's head, but then the shoulders became stuck in the pelvis and had shoulder dystocia. Normally, you have about 5 minutes before there's brain damage, but sadly, even after hours of struggling, they could not deliver the baby, and it soon passed away, still stuck partway outside the mother's body. Eventually, transport was found. Although the transport was found, and she made the day-long journey to the hospital, still laboring and with the baby's head stuck on her perineum. This voyage took her over bumpy, muddy roads in the back of a pickup truck, and then across the Kavango River on a traditional canoe. And this is the river that separates Namibia from Angola. And she eventually made it to the doors of our hospital. Under anesthetic and with great difficulty, I was able to deliver the baby girl vaginally, and I then proceeded the even more difficult task to try to repair her bladder. And this is a primary care physician who's doing this. And as expected, she developed also a vaginal fistula as part of her experience. And then the third lady was a young girl who was 18 years of age, and she arrived at our hospital. She had a temperature of 40 degrees Celsius. She had headache, abdominal pain, all which suggested malaria. But I examined her, and it revealed a large uterus, an open cervix, and tissue suggestive of a partially aborted pregnancy. Septic abortion was my working diagnosis. While curetting, I found something hard up in her uterus that seemed very peculiar. Using forceps, I was able to remove a 5-centimeter sharpened twig that must have been inserted to induce this abortion. The young lady never did confess to us how the stick ended up there and even denied that she was pregnant. She likely induced the abortion herself and then led us astray with the story that she was not pregnant. So when you're hearing these lectures, especially the students, they need to realize that these are actual people in Africa and India that have been through these things. And so those are just three basic stories that kind of help us focus on what we're talking about. I also will show you some geographical slides, and the main thing you just need to look at when you look at these slides is that these darkened colors all represent areas in the world where maternal deaths are the greatest, and you can certainly see from this that in India and the sub-Saharan Africa area, I was in Kenya, I was in East Africa, the countries that surround Kenya are Somalia, Sudan, Ethiopia, Uganda, Tanzania, all these areas have the highest maternal deaths in the world. Then when you look at Africa itself, you will see that certainly areas that are white, for sure I know, I just got back from Somalia about 3 weeks ago, and the reason why this is white is because the country's not able to give them any details about what's going on in the country. So it's not because it's low, it's just because it's an area that's no details are found. But certainly Kenya, Ethiopia, all the countries in here, the maternal death is very, very high. If you specifically look at ratios, and this is called lifetime risk of death due to pregnancy or childbirth. In North America, it's 1 in 3,700. Asia, it's 1 in 65. And in Africa, it's 1 in 16. And can you imagine, I mean, there's probably 16 women here that may eventually have a baby one time. One would die if you were in Africa. If you're in America, you're probably safe, but not in Africa. What about neonatal, newborn deaths? The same thing is true. And Vic discussed some of these when he showed you some slides, but it basically shows you that neonatal deaths, maternal deaths, India, sub-Saharan Africa, that's where it's the highest. And then if you look at child deaths, it's still the same. This was all taken off the World Health Organization document just a few years ago in 2003. But you can also see India, very, very high. The numbers are huge. In sub-Saharan Africa, all of it's right in here. We're right there. I don't see a red dot anywhere at Vanderbilt or in Tennessee. Although it happens, it's very small. This also shows, this is one of those bar graphs that should help you remember those three stories that I talked about. And it talks about Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean. And you can just see the difference between neonatal deaths, stillbirths, maternal deaths, how it drops off when you talk about developing countries. Now, I, after being 4 years again in Africa and coming back to an institution like Vanderbilt, I'm always surprised about the number of people. A baby is born in the unit or a C-section is done. There's a neonatologist, there's a neonatal fellow, there's a couple of nurses, there's a couple of medical students. And can you just imagine, we're contrasting that to the situation that you described where there's a illiterate mother trying to help another mother deliver a baby. It's a totally different situation. And so as you're rotating through, if you're a student and you see what's going on at Vanderbilt, you need to try to remember what's going on in the vast majority of the world. It's not like it is at Vanderbilt. What about the presence of health workers? Now, this is also a slide that Vic demonstrated these same types of figures, but you can basically see that the countries with a shortage are this dark burnt orange. The countries where there's really not a shortage is this area. And you can contrast that to the geographical figures that I showed you just a minute ago, and you can see that when there's no presence of health workers, there's basically a lot of problems with mothers, children, and the neonates. And as far as anesthesia goes, in 1995 when we went to Kenya, we noticed that there weren't any consultant or attending anesthesiologists outside the big cities. And certainly in the big cities, you can get medical care if you have money. If you don't have money, you live in a big city, it's more difficult to get medical care. In Kenya, very few consultants lived outside the big cities. And so for the rural population, they really didn't have people that were trained to do surgery, anesthesia, obstetrics, pediatricians, and those types of things. And there's a lot of reasons why that's the case, but certainly that's what we noticed, that's what was happening there. This is a very blurred slide, but basically it just shows the same things that we talked about, is that in these countries where there's fewer skilled attendants, there are more problems. And then this is also a slide that shows you the same type of figures, is that this shows you the percentage of skilled attendants at delivery. And you can see as it goes down, the maternal deaths go up. And so education is a very important part of maternal child health in countries that are still developing. And that's what I'm going to talk about in just a minute, how that worked out for us. WHO estimated for the next 10 years that more than 2.5 million women will die during pregnancy, childbirth, or the 6 weeks following delivery. And that's one per minute, but if you just look at Africa alone, that's one female dies every 2 minutes. So we've been talking for 25 minutes, and you can just calculate how many women have died in that period of time. And it's because of a lot of training. There's a lot of reasons why we can help that. 49 million in the WHO Africa region will have short or long-term disabilities, and we'll talk about what disabilities are, which will affect their productivity and contribution to the social and economic development. Now, what is a disability? Disability, you remember I just told you those three stories? All three of those women had disabilities. The first lady had a VVF. The second lady had a VVF. The third probably had infertility problems, was potentially going to have infertility problems. So all of those are disabilities. And those are three women that did not die, but those are three women that are going to have major problems the rest of their life. Could be anemia, infertility, incontinence, a VVF, chronic pelvic pain, or depression. And so when you look at these maternal figures and you see there's a female that died every 2 minutes in Africa, there's 40 that are going to have one of these problems. And I don't know if you've been to some of these small villages in India and Africa and developing countries. If you have a VVF, no one wants to be around you. You can't get out of your hut. You're not going to have more children. You're not going to have a husband that takes care of you. And you potentially could starve. So what are the obstacles of safe motherhood? This was also taken from one of the WHO articles that I looked at. Basically, there's the first in the delay, and that's we don't recognize the danger signs, the lack of birth preparedness by the family and community. The second is reaching the facility, and that's a big problem in a lot of these countries, is you can't even get to the hospital where you're working. In our hospital, we live 45 minutes from a large community. No cars, no bicycles. And so for them to get to the hospital, even though by vehicle it's 45 minutes, for them it's a 6 to 8 hour walk. And I have five children. My wife's been through labor. And when she's in labor, she was in a lot of pain. And she was the first thing she said when she hit the door of the hospital in Colorado was, "Where's the anesthesiologist? I want an epidural." But these women are walking for miles to get to the hospital. The third thing is receiving appropriate care once you arrive in the hospital. And that may be you don't have skilled attendants, you don't have the equipment, you don't have the drugs, you don't have the supplies, and then the whole referral system is skewed. I would just add to that that in many of these countries, the status of women in society is lower, and certainly in Africa that's the case. And then young women come up and they're pregnant. They may not be considered the main person in the village or the most important person in the family. So she may have major problems, and they may say, "Well, we don't have that much money to take her to the hospital," and so she's not going to go, or they may not even recognize the signs. The second one is distrust of the healthcare services. Certainly in our area, we had many people in 1997 that were coming to the hospital. They'd gone to two or three district hospitals or a sub-district hospital, and there was no one there to do anesthesia. There was no one there to do the cesarean sections. And so finally, when they got to our hospital, the infant had already died. The mother was having major problems, and so the people hear those stories, and they tell their friend who tells their next person, and so they don't trust the medical system there. And then it's the cost. Even if it's a government hospital where they may say, "You come to our hospital and you'll receive care," you still have to buy your IV cannula, you still have to buy your fluids, your drugs. They may not have the money to do those things. So what is an anesthesiologist? What was he doing in Africa? I mean, this was a picture of me with three Maasai guys who... Certainly when you go into a country, you have to meet the leaders, either the government leaders or the traditional leaders, and talk to them and say, we're here to help. How can we help you? I did this talk at the Grand Rounds, and I told them this is the Department of Anesthesia when I first arrived. I came and had to meet the chairman of the Department of Anesthesia, but that's not the case. Vic showed this slide, and this is a great diagram of what causes maternal deaths. And certainly hemorrhage is a big one. But all these other issues come into play when you're talking about once the patient arrives to the hospital, what happens to them? Certainly abortion. At the government hospital in Nairobi, they have 10 women per day that come with an abortion. And it's not a spontaneous abortion. It's something they've gone to the slum area, and they've induced the abortion. So they come in, they're septic, and so that's 10 a day at Nairobi Kenyatta National Hospital. And you can imagine the morbidity associated with that. So after we moved there, we decided that we needed to start training nurses to do anesthesia. And so we started a nurse anesthesia program. And after about 5 years working through the government, working through a curriculum, getting the Nursing Council of Kenya and the Ministry of Health in Kenya to say it's okay to have an official anesthesia program where you train nurses to work in the rural setting, we were able to have an official program. Of course, when we first went there, we went ahead and started training nurses. And those were the nurses that were working in the rural sector. Those were the nurses that were working at district hospitals, sub-district hospitals, small mission hospitals. And so this was the first class. This was the people that I know. We chose two nurses from five rural hospitals, including our own hospital. We developed a curriculum, had it approved, and that's what we used to teach the nurses over a 12 to 18 month period how to take care of women and also certainly adults and neonates and children, how to do anesthesia, how to resuscitate. And these were the ones that were sent back out to the rural areas to take care of those problems. And so these are just a few slides. That's one of the anesthesia nurses doing neonatal, pediatric, and certainly adult anesthesia. And you can see this. This is very different than some of the pictures I'm going to show you in a couple of minutes. We had monitors. We had anesthesia machines. We had little trays here. We had some medications. Those were all brought into the country. These were hospitals that didn't have money to be able to buy these things. And so these were all things that were thrown away at the hospitals in North America that they didn't want them. And I'm sure Vanderbilt has a big storeroom somewhere. And you'd bring these things to Africa or India or other countries and you realize that they're still usable. And so that's what we used. Certainly we decided to show people how to use a computer. So we had one computer for the school. We gave them little tutorials on how to use the computer. And as a result of that, they were able to hook up the internet and get information about how to provide anesthesia, how to resuscitate patients from that. What are some other factors as far as anesthesia services in developed countries? Supplies are always an issue. It's hard to get drugs in the urban and the rural setting. There's a critical shortage of trained people, as I just mentioned. And then certainly maintenance of equipment. You can get those machines and those monitors and pulse oximeters and things brought to a country. But if they break down, the electricity goes like this, and it blows out all of your monitors. And so all those things are issues that I'm sure that people here at Vanderbilt Children's Hospital, they really don't have to think about. There was a study that an anesthesiologist from the UK sent a survey out. This was in the country of Uganda, which is right next to Kenya. And she asked all of the anesthesia care providers who were in the country some questions. And basically what she got from the survey was that out of all of the anesthesia, these were people who were trained in anesthesia. Only 6% could provide safe C-section anesthesia in the whole country of Uganda. And these were the ones who actually were trying to get educated. These were the ones who had been through programs, either anesthesia programs or nurse anesthesia programs or clinical officer anesthesia programs. Other things that came from this survey, that in Uganda, 54% had reliable oxygen, 23% had blood transfusion available. So you can imagine someone coming in and you've been trained to resuscitate a baby. Baby comes out, you don't have any oxygen. You don't have an ambu bag. You don't have an IV cannula. You don't have any fluids to give the patients. So there's a lot of issues involved in training someone to resuscitate a baby that may be even more than just doing the airway. Certainly, CME is unavailable in many African countries. So CME is a critical issue as far as training nurses, training doctors about various issues. So as a result of that, we had our referral hospital. We brought students, medical students, residents, nurses to our hospital and trained. Then we decided to start going out. So we would do these surgical safaris. This was in an area of northern Kenya where we would go out and just teach anesthesia on how to do a C-section. So we would teach young medical officers or nurses how to do a spinal. And this certainly wasn't, I hope this wasn't someone that was going to have a spinal for a C-section, but basically, we did a cesarean section. We did spinal anesthesia in a very basic way. I just got back from Somalia. We've been up there 6 or 7 times. This was an area where the one surgery that they try to do for an area that covers about a 500 square mile area is a cesarean section. And they do one cesarean section every week, even though it's an area that's basically 500 square miles. So there's a number of women out there that are dying as a result of no one able to do the C-section, and certainly no one able to do the spinal for the anesthesia. So we would go up there, and we just got back, and we started training the medical students how to do the anesthesia for the cesarean sections. And so these are all medical students that are learning how to do spinals, so they will be the anesthesia care providers for the hospital because there's no one else to do it. And so they would be the ones that were the most trained to do it. Certainly I went to Sudan many times, and this was a guy that the Civil War started when he was in the sixth grade. No more school. He had finished sixth grade, so he reached the level of an anesthesiologist. I said that if he had only made it to fifth grade, he could have become a surgeon, but since he went to sixth grade, he became an anesthesiologist. And so that's a typical hospital that you would work in, at least in Africa. We went and did lectures on when to give blood, things like this. And also we had visiting professors that would come out. And that's something that Vanderbilt's interested in doing, is taking medical students, residents, interns, attendings, and have them come out. This is a guy that was president of the American Board of Anesthesia. He would come out to Kenya, and he would lecture for 1 month on how to give anesthesia to babies. Now, this would be a typical hospital that the UN runs. So when you think about anesthesia, resuscitation, and once they make it to the hospital, what do you do? Well, this is the OR for the biggest refugee camp in Kenya, 175,000 to 200,000 refugees. This is where the women would go for a cesarean section. The anesthesia is right back here. These two bottles, those are ketamine. And so your anesthesia would be ketamine. This would be your table. And then there would be a lot of strapping to strap the mother down so you could do the cesarean section. Certainly, if you don't have access to incubators and things, you work in hospitals. What we were involved in as far as neonatal care is certainly to build our own incubators. And so you have to do what you can do. So these are all just pictures to remind me that in these countries, you have to be able to improvise and build things. You can't bring everything over from the United States or from Canada to do that. So that's where this was the room that one of my children was born in. And certainly having oxygen, having a neonatal place where you could resuscitate the baby, having obviously some light, having a blood pressure cuff, all of these things are things that are needed when you talk about maternal health once they reach the hospital. Again, we had to bring over a lot of the equipment so we could take care of patients, and Vic actually went over this, so I won't go over that again. The other things we were involved in is teaching medical students, nurses, to go out in the community. So we had 54 clinics. From the clinics, they were spread all over Kenya. From the clinics, they would go out and do basically mobile maternal child health checks. And that's what they would weigh the patients. They would check with the mothers. They would give immunizations and all those types of things. So education was important in that realm. And that's when they would find mothers out there. They had a vehicle. They would put the mother in the vehicle, bring her to the hospital, and that's where they would have care. Certainly education of the mother. I knew Jeff would be here, and it's interesting that I found this slide, but transportation is a bigger issue than you think. And so this was a slide that I recently found, and we've talked about this, Jeff, before, of how do you get a mother or someone who's sick to the hospital if there's no vehicles? And this was a design that I saw on the internet, and certainly this was from the WHO in Malawi. And it seems like a small little device, but this is where with grant money that if you could just basically build something like this, put it in a village with 50 huts basically and get this for the village chief or someone that was in the village, they could get patients to the hospital. 75% of maternal deaths are preventable. What do we do here at Vanderbilt? We need to develop partnerships with universities such as where these men are from, and also be involved in anesthesia services, certainly education and research. We need to focus our efforts in certain areas. We can't say we're going to try to do something for the whole world. We need to choose areas where we're going to focus on. And then also we need to, as anesthesia care providers, we need to seek funding so we could be involved in education and research. The end result is you have someone who lives out in a village. These are friends of mine. She was taken care of by someone that came to visit her in their hut. She had good prenatal care. She had a nice delivery. But if she did have problems, we could get her to the hospital. So the end result, although I told you those stories, those horrific stories of those three African women who were involved and had major problems, this is what we want to see. We want to see a father and a mother and a baby and the whole village happy as a result of what care they received. Okay, thanks, Vic.
Thank you, Mark. Excellent presentation. I think we have exceeded the time, but we're going to have the panel for about 10 minutes. And if I can request both the speakers, Dr. Gowder and Dr. Newton, as well as We also have Dr. B.R. Desai, who is the chair of the Department of OBGYN at JNMC, who does a lot of work in providing care for women attending the hospital, as well as does a number of research protocols related to OBGYN, is here, and I'm glad he could join us. May I also request Dr. B.S. Kodkani, who is also, we are fortunate to have him visit us. He's a senior professor emeritus at JNMC and has been instrumental in launching a number of these studies and a lot of community work to also join on the panel. And I'm going to start off the discussion with asking the panel one question and then leave it open to the audience. And if you were to, you know, basically give one example where we can make the biggest impact on maternal and child health, I'm talking about both for women as well as for children, what would that be? It's a pretty general question, but something which can get us started thinking about the issue. I know we heard a lot about things, but if you were to pick one, what would that be?
I think we need to go into have some pediatric collaboration in the field of pediatrics and neonatology.
I mean, all the three presentations kind of focused the magnitude of the problem, you know, where the, you know, issues are, where the problems are. And we are not going to get skilled birth attendants in all these places overnight. It will take another 50 years for sure. We are not going to get referral facilities at these places. So challenge really is to get simple interventions which can be implemented even in a low resource setting and then see if they can make a difference. I think that's really what, you know, we need to be looking at. Yes, we need research, basic research, bench research. There's no question about it. But unless that bench research eventually goes out into the community, it's of no use. So that's